Born in Toronto, Jaime Barrizo is the author of The Cumulus Effect, a prize-winning poet, critic, and performer. Her work has appeared in Agni, Book Forum, Boston Review, and the Los Angeles Review of Books. She is the recipient of fellowships and awards from Bennington College, the New School, the Jerome Foundation, and Poets House. A classically trained musician and a champion of cross-genre work, Jaime Barrizo has performed sound text collaborations with musicians and groups such as The National, Bon Iver, and the American String Quartet. Jaime Barrizo, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
You're calling us from New York?
Yes, New York City.
New York City. You know, I know that you travel quite a bit, you know, performing your music and now your book, of course, The Cumulus Effect. What a wonderful book. I mean, even from the cover, right? The cover of it's really nice and moody and it's blue. I know our listeners can't see it. So it's a photograph of sort of these bed sheets that are like, you know, disheveled. And it's really a moody book. And tell us really quickly just about the cover. What made you want to pick that for the book?
Well, that's an interesting cover. That's actually, it's such a process for any writer, I think, to choose the artwork for their first book. And my wonderful publisher, Four Way Books, they gave me a lot of artistic freedom.
Nice.
And I gave them a number of works by artists that I loved, including this photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And they chose this photograph, and it's actually one that I took myself.
Oh, so it's your photograph.
Yeah, I took it in Havana.
Oh, wow, nice, okay.
And I didn't tell them that I was the photographer, so I wanted them to just choose what they thought would fit the, you know, temperament of the book.
Totally.
So I was very pleased, and it's very special to me that this is on the cover of The Cumulus Effect.
Yeah, you didn't want to, like, bias them, you know, and then be like, who does she think? She's a photographer, too? You know?
Yeah.
I know. I'll do that, too. I'll just slide, like, you know, I'll send them, like, for art cover ideas, send them different photographs, and then just slip one of mine in there and see how that works.
Right.
And this is your first publication, right?
Yes, my first book.
How does it feel?
It feels great. It's a wonderful feeling to have poems that you've worked on for so long suddenly be out there in the world. It's very special. It's still, I'm still on this kind of high from having it out there in the world.
Like, I remember when I first got my first book, too, it was like the first thing I did was crack open the box and smell all the books. You know?
Right.
So how long did you work on this this collection? I mean, from, you know, all the poems in there, how long did it take to kind of work them to the point?
I started this book in 2007, actually. And the last poems were written maybe the year before the book was accepted for publication in 2013. So it's, you know, a process of maybe 5 years where the poems went through a lot of different lives. If you look at the poems, they're very minimalist.
Right.
They're mostly untitled.
Yeah.
That didn't used to be the case. They used to all have titles.
Right.
And now the book more, it's the structure is more, each section is based in a different city.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of the cumulus effect that I was talking about.
The title of the book is The Cumulus Effect. And, you know, the poems are, you know, they're quiet. I want to say even contemplative, definitely minimalist. And they kind of reminded me, just based on the word cumulus, you know, I thought of them actually as sort of cumulus clouds, kind of one by one drifting past in a sort of quiet contemplation, you know. And I read the book in one sitting. What I liked about this book so much is that, you know, I just took the time to savor the language. So tell me a little bit about the title then, The Cumulus Effect. Tell me how that, you know, I guess sets up the poems inside.
Yes, well, you're right. It's kind of based on those shape-shifting clouds and the state of impermanence that cumulus clouds have. So cumulus, it's from the Latin. It's a noun, you know, that means heap or a pile. Mm. And so these clouds are often in patterns, sequential patterns, and there's an accumulation of them.
Wow.
And for me, the book is about this accumulation of memory,
right?
Of different spaces places.
You know, actually, because you and I, we both met actually as graduate students at the Bennington Writing Seminars in Vermont.
Right.
And, by any chance, did you ever take a course with Ed Ochester when you were there?
Yes, I did. He was my thesis advisor.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Well, I don't know if he told you this, but Ed, you know, he told me one time during a workshop there, he said, He said, you know, Tim, some poets are putter-inners and others are ticker-outers, which meant for him, you know, that some poets use a lot of language in their work, like me, and others were more minimalist or maybe more strategic, maybe, you know. And I could hear Ed saying, Jaime, you're a ticker-outer. Did he ever tell you that?
I'm not sure if he ever did, but that's a good definition, definitely.
Ed had an eloquent way of breaking down, you know, poetry.
Right.
Did you enjoy your experience there at Bennington? I mean, how'd that work for you when you were there?
For me, it was a really important time as a writer and evolving as an artist.
Right.
And also, special for me is that maybe a year and a half before I went to Bennington, I had my first child. So part of Bennington and the experience was kind of reclaiming my space as an artist and as a writer,
right.
You know, and carving that space out of motherhood and trying to compartmentalize my life and make it into a sequence that worked for me as an artist. So right. Bennington really helped me kind of solidify these things in my mind.
Sure. For me, too, when I was there, Bennington, it's a low residency program, so we only have to, so, you know, students would only attend, this is for the listeners out there, students would only attend the program, like, you know, I think 10 days in the summer and 10 days in the winter time. And absolutely. I know that, you know, myself as a father of three, you know, it was definitely a very vital space for me to go and sit down and spend my time writing and working on whatever I was working on. So did you work, were the poems in this a part of your thesis when you were there? Were they part something that you were working through?
Some of them were in my thesis, but funny thing that you said about the cutting down, a lot of these were much longer poems, that my thesis had much longer poems, and I just was cutting and cutting away from them until they turned into these minimalist type of dream fragments or snippets of memory that are in the book now. And one of the things that was really special about Bennington and connects with my work is that I believe that the spaces of our past solitudes, they remain indelible in our mind, and that comes through in our work, and especially my work, since a lot of it has to do with the intersections between geography and memory, so location and memory.
Right. That's interesting that you say that about geography and memory. I mean, you're originally from Toronto, right?
Yes, a lot of born out in a suburb of Toronto in southern Ontario.
Right. And then I know also that your parents were originally from the Philippines and that they moved here shortly before you were born. I mean, you know, and when you talk about sort of geographical spaces and memory playing a role in these poems, you know, how does does their background or your family's background play a role in your writing?
I really believe that it has. I mean, I'm really interested in Italo Calvino's idea of the continuous city.
Ah, yes, definitely.
You know, and there's huge cities in the Philippines I visited for the first time in my adult life a few years ago. Like Manila is this huge, bustling metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
And the cities in my book are like New York, Berlin, St. Right. Petersburg. And so Calvino, he has this quote that that means a lot to me, and it says, arriving at each new city, the traveler finds again a past of his that he did not know he had.
Right.
The foreignness of what you no longer are or no longer possess lies in wait for you in foreign, unpossessed places. And, you know, that's how I felt when I went to my parents' homeland for the first time. And I think that's a big thing that's part of my this book, is that disorientation and vulnerability that you feel when you go into a place you've never been or you see a part of your past that you haven't explored before.
This might get a little esoteric here, but at the opening of the book, you know, you have this epigraph that refers to this concept of the memory palace, which is, you know, what really intrigued me actually about the book as I opened it for the first time, you know, because myself, I'm pretty immersed in the idea of memory, and I've been researching memory for the last few years also. And I know that this concept of the memory palace is just kind of, I think it's rooted like an ancient Roman or Greek. Anyway, it's a technique. Basically, it's a technique for remembering. where a person, and today they use this technique frequently all over the world, you know, where a person uses visualization to create a kind of, I guess, a kind of a palace where they have these, where in each room is where they place certain things that they want to remember. Anyway, it's a technique right. for remembering. So it's really an interesting concept. And, you know, when I read your book, and I realized your book is broken up into these, you know, various sort of sections or various spaces, like you said, New York, Berlin, St. Petersburg, Africa. You know, tell us a little bit about how maybe these individual cities or these individual spaces acted as memory devices for you.
Well, you're right that this is based on Memory Palace. So it's based on the fact that we're very good at remembering places that we know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think as I walk through this book, it's like walking through the past and through spaces that I knew intimately, or they were important in certain markers in my life. It reminds me of something that Gaston Bachelard wrote. Mm-hmm. He's the author of The Poetics of Space. And he said that the mind's localization in the spaces of our intimacy is more urgent and important than the determination of dates.
Yes,
so
yes, totally.
The details of dates, they're not so... It doesn't mean as much to me as where you... where the body finds itself in certain spaces and time.
Right.
And a lot of that's through the senses, you know.
Right, and how memory has a tendency to sort of blur the lines, right, in terms of geography and time. Sometimes, you know, our own memories, you know, of being in a particular space clash with other memories or actually combine with other memories and conjoin with other memories. And suddenly we in our own minds, you know, we'll have a really kind of a different recollection of an instance than what, quote unquote, actually took place,
right.
you know. And right. I love that about the book, because even in the different spaces that you have, these different, you know, locations, there is still a kind of a melding between the work, you know, between one city and another. You know, I wonder too, you're a classically trained musician as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's your instrument? What instruments do you play?
My first instrument is piano, and I also play violin.
Ah, okay. For some reason, I thought you were a cellist, but maybe I was making that up. Maybe that was my memory of a conversation we had. In music, too, probably even more than in writing, perhaps, you know, there's this use of memory, obviously, right, to remember, you know, muscle memory and obviously, you know, things like that. And so I wonder how much of that approach, you know, in terms of your music informs your writing.
Well, music is definitely a big part of my life and always has been since I've been a child. So, I think that my writing, I hope, you know, that it makes use of certain musical things like echo, silence.
And I can see that, because in your writing, there are these silences, you know, I mean, there's a lot of white space on the page. So it gives us a lot of room to kind of gives the reader a lot of room to, like I said earlier, savor the words, but also consider what's being said and consider the space that the words are sort of occupying for us. So in the same way, I would imagine, you know, when I hear violin or piano or music, any music in general, it occupies the space. And I'm wondering then, like, you know, as a piano player or as a musician, are these kind of things that you intentionally think about maybe when you're writing, or they just kind of sort of come naturally to you as you're writing?
I mean, I think it's definitely something that has developed and is learned, you know, as a musician. I think when you talk about music, the first thing that comes to my mind is sound. Mm. So when I'm writing, I'm hearing not just the words in my mind, but the spaces. So this
right.
comes across as, I think, as the white page, the white space on the page.
Right.
So fragments. Echoes, they're a big thing in my work. The use of repetition,
right.
The use of motifs.
Right,
these
right.
are all musical elements
right.
that I guess come through.
And perhaps, you know, it's because I also was aware that you were, you know, a musician as well, a classically trained musician, that I was kind of reading the poetry with that in the back of my mind, you know,
mm-hmm.
with that kind of space. What age were you when you started playing music?
Well, I think I started piano when I was 5 and violin when I was 8. I studied it all the way, you know, I got my master's degree in performance, and then afterwards I also got the MFA in poetry.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. So you have two master's degrees in music and in poetry. That's awesome. That's awesome. Was it your parents that got you into music, or was it like at school, or how did that start for you?
I think as a first generation Asian family, the arts are very important. And so, I was really exposed to music and to poetry at a very early age.
Wow. And
the poetry that I was first introduced to was, you know, very formal and very rhythmical, you know, like Tennyson, Edna St. Vincent Millay, the Canadian First Nation poet E. Pauline Johnson, who was Iroquois.
Right.
So these early influences had this real importance on rhythm to me that I feel carried through to me through the years.
Right, yeah. And that absolutely comes through in the poetry. If you're just tuning in with us, we are speaking with the poet, critic, and musician Jaime Barrizo about her brilliant new collection of poetry titled The Cumulus Effect with Four Way Books. Jaime, how was the process for finding a publisher for this? Was that something that kind of just happened easily for you? Or was that, did you have to like really endure all these rejections first, like most of us?
Well, it's definitely a long process. I can't even count the number of rejections that I think I've garnered over my lifetime. But the book was a finalist for quite a few prizes before it was accepted by Four Way Books. And, you know, it was accepted in one of their open reading series that they had. So, submission periods.
Nice. And you know, you mentioned that they gave you, they gave you some leeway in terms of the cover and all of that. How was the editing process there? Was it like were they really easy to work with in terms of editing?
Very, very easy to work with. There was really minimal edits, and they're wonderful press. They produce a diverse body of work that ranges from experimental to more conservative forms, and you know, I'm very happy to be one of their authors, along with Greg Pardlow, who won the Pulitzer Prize last year, and a lot of just wonderful writers.
Yeah, they really produce great books, and then I was reading recently that you got this, you had this really awesome spread in the New York Times. You know, you were talking about about an artist. Actually, you were talking about an artist. There's this one quote you said where you said, I think you were talking about an artist who you were obsessed with at the time. And you said that to be a poet, you have to understand fixation. So the question is, what are you fixated on these days?
what am I not fixated on? I think that's the poet's dilemma of the poet, right?
Totally. Yes.
To juggle the fixation. Well, I mean, I'm working on a new book of poems based on the fundamentals of sound. So I kind of explore the mechanics of sound. And I'm also writing a novel, which is taking a lot of my time.
Wow, I bet.
I'm very excited on.
You're talking about sound, and I know that you've also done these kind of collaborative performances with groups like, you know, the American String Quartet. Tell me about, like, what do these collaborations consist of? I know that you refer to them as sound text collaborations.
You know, they're all different, and they all kind of take on their own life. Once I start working with other artists, they become kind of these organic creations. So with the American String Quartet, they're more like performance pieces, and I performed one with Frank Bidar and Matea Harvey. That was the first collaboration I did, where we kind of curated a program that was based on When Art Speaks. So we read poems in response to pieces that the string quartet performed. Wow. And, you know, Frank Bidar is a very performative poet, and a lot of his work has to do actually with the art of the performer.
Wow.
And for me, that was very special, too. My early life was really completely taken over by performing and being in the practice room.
Right.
So this kind of collaboration with musicians is very special to me. I feel like in this world where the genres are kind of blending, you know, basically post-genre, you're free to create whatever kinds of artwork, sound pieces. There's not very many limits anymore on what you can do as an artist and a performer.
And I agree that it's always fun to explore that, you know, explore the whatever limits are lingering. You know, it's always nice to push the envelope and kind of work with work collaboratively with other artists, from visual artists to musicians and poetry, of course. And so it's always fun to do that and see where it takes you, you know, in terms of just your own craft. So in terms of the marketing for the book, did you have this sort of big book launch or anything like that?
Forward Books, they did a wonderful job of publicizing. Nice. We had a wonderful garden party in the brownstone of a wonderful photographer, Alvin Booth, that I've also collaborated with. So it was a wonderful evening where I read my poetry, and I also did a collaboration with a guitar player, a piece that we had kind of written together that we performed.
If you're just tuning in now, we've been speaking with the poet, critic, and musician J. May Barriso about her new collection of poetry, The Cumulus Effect. And J. May, will you do us the honors of reading us maybe a couple of poems, because your poems are so short, actually, for our poem of the week?
Yeah, sure. I will read a few small selections from the section New York in The Cumulus Effect.
Cool.
A hindsight of blood, the sill with its speck of ash. Who smoked there? Tea on the lip as a forgetting of another endeavor. Red, aligning quietly on the eaves or beneath the skin. Articulate, articulate. The dream of the wheel, bird sounds. Red of the hip like a wrist. Corsage. In the study of distance, everything meets the eye as pool blue. A cool light, undecided, comes over the city. The cloud-swift sky unbuttons. Everything remembers everything.
Wonderful. Thank you, J. May. That was J. May Barriso reading from her new book, The Cumulus Effect. It's out with Four Way Books. You got to be sure to pick that one up. Thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thanks so much, Jen. It's great to be here.